Oh, y'all look great today. So during the lockdown back in 2020, for almost a whole year, Paula and I moved our dining room table into the living room and our coffee table into the dining room, and we took up jigsaw puzzling. We did 350s, we did 500s, we did 1500s, which we don't recommend, they're maddening. But most of them were 1,000 piece. You know, a lot of them ended up here. Many of you took them home with you after we were done with them. We've never done the same puzzle twice, so once you do them, they're done. And, we would always open up that box of a fresh puzzle, and we'd pour it out on the table, and there's that smell of fresh puzzle dust. Yeah. And then we would look down, and there would be a pile of 1,000 pieces on the table, and it looked so daunting, okay? Until we snapped together those first two pieces, usually an edge, and then we were on our way. We'd be like, two down, 998 to go. And then we would start chipping away at that puzzle until eventually we had a beautiful landscape of a French countryside, or a beautiful photo of the Eiffel Tower, or of a French cafe. We did a lot of French puzzles because Paula loves France. But then when we would finish, we'd put that last piece in and then we'd pat it with our hands, make sure it was good and flat. We'd walk around it and pat ourselves on the back a little bit, how good we did. And then, those Zen monks who do the sand mandalas, intricate, they work on them for weeks, and then when they're done, they say a little prayer over them and just sweep it away. I would take a photo of the puzzle, and then we would just start breaking it up, putting it back in the box, and get ready for the next one. We'd have to give our puzzle brains a couple days to rest, and we'd go into the next one. I know you're wondering, why the heck is he telling me this? So, because it reminded me of a lot of my spiritual journey, okay, especially since becoming a minister and really wanting to embody these principles that I was now licensed and ordained to teach. And so I created in my mind this image of a perfect minister, okay, and I had a great model to go by with Paula. I wanted to always be in integrity, a great listener, to have delivered great, powerful talks every Sunday, to be patient, to be kind, to meditate, to read ravenously and learn. Well, on and on. About 4 years later, needless to say, I'm a little disappointed with my progress, but not too bad. I've made a lot of progress, and then whenever I do, I think, yes, one down, 999 to go. Like that puzzle, it looked like 1,000 things that I needed to fix about myself, 1,000 things to create that picture of myself that I had made up in my mind. So, I used to, I'd find something I wanted to work on, and I'd work on that thing, and I'd work on that thing, and I'd work on that thing, and if it got better, then I'd work on the next thing, work on the next thing. And then one meditation came to me. Why don't I work on the cause of that thing? So I would get the thing I wanted to work on, and then I would meditate and pray on what is the cause, what's causing this? And then that would fix all of that. And then I would like, okay, so what's causing this? And I would take one more step, and I'd fix that, and then that would fix that. And then I'd say, well, what's causing this? And then I would get to the cause of that, root problem of that, and then all of this other stuff would fall in place. And then I'd get to the root cause of that, and all this other stuff would fall in place. And it reminded me of one of my favorite movies, City Slickers. Everybody seen that? Right, so you know where I'm going. Mitch was Billy Crystal, and he was a corporate guy who was trying to get out into under the stress of corporate life. He's having marriage problems. He wasn't happy, so he thought he'd get a few of his friends and go to a dude ranch for a couple of weeks. And this is where Curly, played by Jack Palance, was a lead cattle rustler, legendary cattle rustler, and in the most famous scene. Curly and Mitch found themselves together riding along, and Mitch was opening up his heart about his life, wondering if he'd ever find happiness, worried about his marriage. And then Jack Palance, he got an Academy Award for his part. He had, he's got the cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and he's got his one eye squinting like this. He's going, "You city folk, you spend 50 weeks tying knots in your rope, and then you come up here for 2 weeks and expect them all to just be untied." He said, "You want to know the secret to life?" And Mitch was like, "Yeah, sure." And then Curly holds his finger up. He goes, "This." And Mitch is like, a finger? And Cardi goes, one thing. You focus on that, everything else don't mean poop. And Mitch is like, that's great, but what is the one thing? And Curly says, that's what you got to figure out. And scene. Well, okay, so I'm here to tell you this morning, I have found the one thing. And the great news is that I think it's universal. I think it's going to apply to all of you guys. So I wanted to share it with you. So as we get down to our cause and effects, we finally get down to the one thing. Just like Curly said, the one thing that's at the root of all of this, the one thing that could help me keep my commitments, the one thing that would finally get me exercising, the one thing that would put me in touch with my inner self, the one thing that would get me eating right and not looking outside myself for validation, the one thing that would finally cure me of my perfectionism, okay? I know you're on the edge of your seat. You're on the edge of your seats. Okay, so here it is. And by the way, this one thing, this one thing influences every decision you make in your life, from the big stuff, like what do I want here to offer the world, down to what am I going to have for dinner tonight. Influences every decision you make. Okay, so here it is. And by the way, this is completely under your control because you created it. Okay? Okay, I'm sorry, here it is. And it's not your self-esteem. Okay? It is your sense of self-worth. And I say it's not your self-esteem because the two are very different, although they a lot of times they get used synonymously. So here's a definition of self-esteem I found from a man named Sam Wolf. He blogs for a website called The Happy Place, which I looked around. It's a very interesting website. He says, this is self-esteem. Self-esteem is the manner in which we evaluate ourselves. It is our internal, our internal assessment of our qualities and attributes, okay? In other words, our self-esteem is how we compare ourselves to others. It's a litmus test against how successful we feel, how loved and respected we feel. Self-worth, this is Sam Wolf again, self-worth is the belief that you are lovable and valuable regardless of how you evaluate your traits. So you see, your self-esteem can change from day to day depending on how successful you are, depending on your outward validation, but your self-worth never changes. It remains the same through all. Your self-esteem relies on outside validation, whereas your self-worth comes completely from inside. But this is This is from a psychiatrist named, let me find her name here. Sorry about that. Is it up there? Oh, Christine Hibbert, there it is. Yeah, this is professional show business. I'm just kidding, it's not show business. Okay, so she says, self-esteem is what we think and feel about ourselves. Wait, where am I? Holy smokes. I'm just going to read it. Self-esteem is what we think and feel and believe about ourselves. Self-worth is recognizing that I am greater than all of those things. It's a deep knowing that I am of value, that I am lovable, necessary to this life, and of incomprehensible worth. And she goes on to say that it's possible to feel high self-esteem and still feel convinced, not convinced that you're lovable and worthy. She says, self-esteem doesn't last or work without self-worth. That's why I believe the pursuit of self-esteem is a myth. So you get that? What she's saying is, seek ye first self-worth, all right? And self-esteem will be added to you, the one thing. So I want to begin by remembering that self-esteem, self-worth, like I mentioned earlier, it's completely man-made, okay? It's most likely originated in the early Christian church. Probably the biggest sin of the early church was to deem some people worthy of God's grace and some people unworthy of God's grace. There's nothing divine or godly about that idea. First of all, it's dualistic. So it doesn't even exist in the mind of God. You are worthy of all of the kingdom of heaven simply because you're born. Who in here was born? That's almost everybody. Okay. As I look around. You're made in the image and likeness of your Creator. So you came into this world with sacred worth. And no one can take that away from you. Only you can take it away from you. So if self-esteem is how you feel about yourself, your self-worth is how much you feel you deserve. It's how much you feel you deserve in life. And this is where we find the self-worth is that one thing at the root of our manifestation process in life as well. Think of your self-worth as the aperture through which your good flows, okay? If you're living from a place of unworthiness, it's like taking a thimble up to that ocean of abundance and asking God to fill that up for you. This is all you want. This is all you deserve. When in reality, you could pull a tanker truck up or 10 tanker trucks up and ask God to fill it, and God would fill it for you. Remember, it's God's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Okay, but you have to do your part. Okay, you don't walk into a dark room and just sit there and wait for the lights to come on, right? You have to do something. You have to flip the switch. And there's a great example of this in the New Thought parable of the prodigal son that Jesus told us. And we all know the story. The youngest son asked for his father's inheritance. And this was strange because the father hadn't died yet. Usually you get your inheritance after the man dies. But you know, the father never questioned him. He never said, well, what have you done to earn your inheritance? Have you been a good son? Nothing. Without question, he gave it to him. And as we know, the young son ran off to a foreign land, squandered his inheritance, and then a famine came, and he ended up just being starving and just wishing he could at least just go home and be a servant at his father's house. So he headed back home, and he was quite surprised at what he found. His father welcomed him with open arms. In fact, he welcomed him in a big way. He wanted a big party, kill the fatted calf, put the robe on him and the ring, the family ring on him, and celebrate with him. You see, the young son never fell out of favor with his father, not when he asked for his inheritance or not when he squandered it and returned home. However, the older brother, he had his own issues with self-worth. Okay, when he said, for all these years I've been working like a slave for you and you have never disobeyed, I've never disobeyed your command, yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. Now, do you think this father who gave his youngest son his inheritance, welcomed him home after he squandered it, would have denied his oldest son a goat to celebrate with his friends? No, of course not. So what's the difference? What's the difference between the two brothers in the way they approached their father? The youngest son asked. He did something. He flipped the switch. He somehow saw himself worthy to ask and to accept. The older brother was in thimble consciousness, okay? He was in a dark room, just waiting for the lights to come on. Now, I believe Jesus' healings were also about self-worth. I think when he told the people he healed that your faith has made you whole, he was really telling them, you have seen yourself as whole. When he told the man at the pool of Bethesda, when he asked him, do you want to be healed? I think he was really asking him, do you feel worthy to be healed? He'd been there for 38 years. It was a logical question to ask him. But Jesus showed him, you're born, so you're worthy to be healed. Now, research has shown that people who have low self-worth are often more vulnerable to certain illnesses and mental health. And because they don't feel that they can control their own lives. And the only thing left is external control. Okay, so they sought that out in Jesus. And Jesus showed them how to release their own power of healing through their faith and their self-worth. Okay? So now that we know the one thing, let's look at how we can cultivate that sense of self-worth. So I've come up with five things that I'm working on. This is how the first five, because there's probably many, many more than this. Five ways to improve your self-worth. The first one is divine expectancy. Expectancy. The great Unity teacher, Eric Butterworth, he wrote Spiritual Economics, a great book. He said that there's more to the manifestation process than just our thoughts and intentions. This is what he said in his book. You do not draw to you what you want. You do not draw to you what you pray for, not even what you have faith in. Then he says, you will always draw to you what you actually expect. You have to expect it. If you've been affirming for something with little or no results, don't just keep affirming harder and longer. Check in on your expectancy around that desire. When you buy a lottery ticket, do you expect to win? I know I don't. That's why I don't buy them. It's just like, it would be useless. But if you take a little deeper look, you'll find that you can only expect what you think you deserve. You can only expect to draw to you what you think you deserve. And guess what? What you think you deserve comes from your self-worth, the one thing underlying your manifestation process. So Jesus said, ask knowing you will receive and you will receive. Try saying, ask expecting to receive and you will receive. That has a lot more energy. It has a different energy to it, doesn't it? Ask expecting. Expectation is an emotional vibration. Whereas knowing, you know, it's very cognitive. It feels like in here. But expectation, it's very emotional. And that's what goes out and finds that vibration to tell the universe this is what you want when you expect it. Okay, so number one, divine expectancy. Number two, this advice, see yourself as wondrously made. It's advice from the oldest known language on the planet. Right? The Sanskrit word for prayer literally means to see yourself as wondrously made. Okay, this begins to help you to live your life from your divine center. Right? How could you see yourself as wondrously made and not feel worthy? Reverend Linda Martella-Witsit, who wrote her book, How to Pray Without Talking to God, and she also wrote Divine Audacity, which is a class that Reverend Ann and I are going to be teaching coming up very soon. She says that the only purpose to prayer is to realize your divine potential so that you may live more fully from it. Excuse me. In other words, the only purpose to prayer is to see yourself as wondrously made. And then you begin to see yourself as worthy. Remember, you can't create something you think you don't deserve. Right? Number three. This always comes up, doesn't it? Forgive yourself for past mistakes, for past choices. I still tend to beat myself up over some of the decisions I made years ago around my career and how I went about achieving my goals. But you know, holding on to that regret has just been eroding and eroding and eroding away my sense of self-worth long after those decisions were made. So we have to show ourselves compassion and understanding. You don't have to deny that what you did was wrong or that you could have done better. But what you have to do is renounce its power over you. This frees you from the shame of your past. And it prevents you from feeling unworthy. So in this way, self-forgiveness, self-worth, not only changes your present and your future, but it's also the one thing that can change your past. Number four, separate who you are from what you do. Two completely different things. You can still have goals for yourself, but try not to wrap your identity and worth or value into these things, not even into your successes. I felt unworthy because I thought I'd failed. In my career, I still need to come to the realization that my sense of worthiness was not tied to those things I did. It's not tied to my failures or to my successes. It helped me to stop seeking validation outside of myself. Okay, and the very last thing, give up perfectionism. Give up trying to be perfect, okay? The drive to be perfect often comes from the need for approval and acceptance. And that who we are, we want acceptance that who we are is good enough. We need that from outside validation. And if we fall short of that ideal, we've created that ideal for ourselves, as I did after I became a minister, it can inevitably lead to disappointment. So from this consciousness, we can find it very difficult to feel worthy, you know, even for the tiniest thimble amount of grace. So there's five things. Is your self-worth really a choice? Is it really a choice that you make? Well, who else is there judging you? Okay, it's not God. Then who? To whom are you being compared as a measurement of your self-worth? And who's doing the comparing? Who else could possibly determine what you think you deserve? There are other people, parents, family members, even some pastors. They may try to tell you that you're not worthy, but guess what? Their faith in you has nothing to do with what you draw into your life. Only your faith in yourself can determine that. So if you feel like you're beating your head against the wall, you know, trying to improve this or quit that or be a better whatever, remember the one thing. Remember the one thing. Remember, you draw to you what you expect. You expect what you think you deserve. And what you think you deserve is determined by your self-worth. So I'm going to leave you with this one kind of mind-blowing idea that came to me, and it blew my mind. What if your self-worth is also the one thing that differentiates us from Jesus? We're told that we're created in the same divine potential as Jesus. So why aren't we walking this earth? Why aren't we all walking this earth as Jesus did? See, Jesus believed he could do anything God could do. If God can heal the sick, I can heal the sick. God can raise the dead, I can raise the dead. Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore said as much himself. And what greater sense of self-worth could you have than to believe you could do whatever God could do? So if we could all bring our self-worth up to that level, expecting to receive, feeling worthy to receive all of God's abundance, and seeing ourselves as wondrously made, surely we could all co-create anything we wanted for ourselves and for this world. So let's take a few moments now for some prayerful meditation. So let's close our eyes, get comfortable. And we usually start our meditations with a big, deep, cleansing breath. And that's because that breath, when we take that breath together, it brings our attention into this very moment, and it connects us in consciousness. So as we release that big breath, we just feel ourselves connecting to those around us and becoming one. You often hear us say that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. We live our lives torn between two voices, the voice of our human self and the voice of our spiritual self. And I ask you today to choose which one you will serve. Choose this day who you will serve. As we take another breath together, just allow these words to become your words. I am a divine creation of God. I am worthy of all the kingdom of heaven. By divine birthright, I attract to me all that is mine to have. I am lovable. I am worthy. It is God's good pleasure to give me the kingdom. As we enter into a few moments of silence together, I want you to take this little mantra in with you and think of nothing else in the silence. I am wondrously made. I am worthy. I am wondrously made, and I am worthy. In the silence. Made in the image and likeness of God, I have divine worth. I see beyond my human limitations. I'm a spiritual being having a human experience. When I say this, I can see the divine within me. I am wondrously made, and it is the Father's good pleasure to give me the kingdom. For this, we give thanks, for this realization, for this opportunity to share, for this time together this morning. We just let our gratitude flow out into the universe to come back to us full of blessings and full of grace. For this we give thanks, and so it is. Amen.